This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, a surprise voice, a surprise guest, Uma Pagan Ampika Pakin.
Wait, it's 6 a.m. and not 6 p.m.?
Yeah, I know. And I think it'll be a shock for all of you, you know, who are used to hearing Uma later in the day. So we're not going to reveal the secret of why he's here, not till later.
Is there a secret?
So, okay. You know, be at the edge of your seats. Keep speculating wildly about why Uma has appeared in the morning.
Tweet us on BFM Radio.
Yeah, you can actually at BFM Radio. Or send us a WhatsApp at 016-201-9000. That's 016-201-9000. Be part of the conversation about the mysterious appearance, as opposed to disappearance, of Uma Pagan Ampika Pakin. Okay. Thanks so much, Uma, for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Okay. We have a lineup. Sometimes, in fact, most days, Mondays to Fridays, I say it's an exciting lineup. And I'm, often dressed down by Julian Ng, who says, I really need to find a different word to describe the lineup.
Hey, I've seen the lineup this morning and I'm excited.
Okay. And part of the excitement might come from the fact that on the breakfast grill, Melissa Idris, who recorded this before she left the Morning Run for her sabbatical, she speaks to Christian Roykia. He's the managing director of IKEA Southeast Asia.
That's right.
Oh, IKEA. There's a debate, isn't there, about how to say this?
I think Christian Roykia will be able to tell you.
Okay, so he will probably, have the definitive answer on how the name of that company. And of course, a brand that in some ways has made its mark in Malaysia in tremendous ways. I mean, I don't know anybody who doesn't have something from an IKEA in Malaysia.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's more than just made a brand regarding furnishing, right? I mean, it's also a place that a lot of people just go to eat now.
That's right. They go to eat. They go to kind of walk about. There's a lot of feet shuffling going on. When I go there, I think there's things I need to get and I just want to get there.
But get in and get out, right?
Yeah, but there's so many people blocking me and there's like families and they're, sitting on things and they're really enjoying the experience.
You go there to
eat? I don't understand it, but it's clearly happening.
I'm telling you go there to eat whatever meal, lunch, breakfast, dinner. You go there to break up with your significant other. That is something that
really?
Also happens.
Has that happened to you?
No, but I just see a lot of people fighting at IKEA.
Do you? So you go there to eat. I think I've eaten there only once, but I can't say.
I really like their soft serve ice cream.
Oh, is it? Really? Is it
cheap? It's like 1 ringgit 50 cents.
So it's the price point. I mean, is it that? Because you can get sort of like meatballs for cheap. Is that what is it all about?
The food is cheap and it's, you know what? It's tasty.
Okay.
They also do nasi lemak these days.
All right.
So they've gone kind of local as well. I know far too much about the menu in IKEA.
I know. Okay. So Melissa is going to be talking about why Southeast Asia is an important market for the company, how the company is adapting to fit the market, adapting its global brand, and also the resilience of this privately held company. And all that. So there's a lot in the mix coming after the 8 o'clock bulletin.
And also, I believe IKEA has got plans to roll out online shopping. You know, they haven't done that so far because they want to pull people into the stores, right? But they've got a plan to roll out online shopping. So that's going to be something exciting. And I think she asks Christian about that as well.
So I don't know what families are going to do if they, if they're robbed of the experience of going to the store. I mean, because it is so much about the experience, right? And I think a lot of brands try to focus on this idea of the experience. And so, without it, what would IKEA be but another Lazada, one of those kind of online things?
And it's the oldest game in the book, like, right? I mean, you go in to buy a cushion and you leave spending 600 ringgit on, I don't know, stainless steel trays that will look pretty in your kitchen.
With Welsh names.
Exactly.
I mean, so many consonants and missing vowels. See, not only are activists going missing in Malaysia, but so are vowels. But that may be a global issue. You're absolutely right. The experience does seduce you. And I think and that happens, of course, that happens in supermarkets just regularly, doesn't it?
Correct.
To anybody who's sort of like pushing their trolley along and think, and especially people like me who never go to a supermarket with a list.
But that's the common strategy. That's why when you go to your checkout area, there are these cunningly, strategically placed items right there, and they know you will pick it up.
Like a Mentos or something?
Yeah, Mentos, Snickers bars, all kinds of really ridiculous things that you never knew you
all
needed,
made of sugar.
You want. All made of sugar. All made of sugar.
I think it's the sugar craving in us that it sort of like reaches out to all these things. But I must say, I do resist the last minute at the counter purchases. I don't hold, you know, grab a Mentos or a Mars bar, whatever.
I've got a collection of mints, just in my in my drawer.
Also just from the checkout.
Just from the checkout.
We also check out on current affairs after the 8:30 news, the global economy. And our guest is Paul Donovan. He's the global chief economist at UBS Wealth Management. And so that's happening after the 8:30 news. Before we go into more talk about business, because there have been indicators or signs that the global economy is getting healthier. There's been a huge story about the being in the era of slow growth. And so that's the big global story. So maybe growth will pick up. But there are perhaps some headwinds, and a lot of the headwinds seem to be coming from politics. We have had tensions on the Korean Peninsula.
That's right.
We've had that,
the president is in prison.
The president of South Korea is in prison.
That's right.
That country is in sort of political limbo at this point in time. North Korea and its third generation dictator, Kim Jong Un,
is testing missiles.
Is testy. And but so is the perhaps less so the president of the United States of America, now kind of dialing down on some of his rhetoric, pre-presidential rhetoric, including NATO. He's come out to say that perhaps NATO does have a role and is not as obsolete as he used to think.
Yeah.
And so that's changed things a little bit, at least in terms of the relationship that he has with his counterparts in continental Europe.
But it's a really exciting time, if only because for the first time in a long time, America hasn't, or at least the Trump administration, hasn't worked out its relationships with the rest of the world yet. I mean, after the meeting with the Chinese premier, everyone's still scrambling to find out where Trump, Tillerson, where they all stand with China.
Yeah.
They haven't got anything down, on paper.
You know, we had a very interesting breakfast grill last week on Friday, looking at the Xi Jinping-Donald Trump meeting.
I heard that with Alina Noor.
And Bundagara.
That's right.
And a professor from the Rajaratnam School in Singapore, Professor Lee. So what Bund says is they had to look at Washington in terms of the rising of competing factions. So he says Steve Mnuchin and his gang are pragmatists, they kind of know the world, and they're not ideologically driven. And he thinks that they're rising, and the star of Steve Bannon and others of his ilk, the ideologically driven members of Trump's cabinet, are actually having trouble now. They're being pushed out. In fact, Steve Bannon was removed from the National Security Council.
He was, and they're also now pondering, but there are bets out as to who's going to go first, whether it's going to be Sean Spicer or Steve Bannon. And there's also apparently a huge conflict between Jared Kushner, who is Trump's son-in-law, who has a very prominent role now as a White House advisor, and Steve Bannon.
Yeah. And in fact, many will look at, Jared Kushner, the part of the taint of nepotism, apart from that, apparently he's very reliable. So, that's the talk, that he is good at what he's doing, but he's been given far too many responsibilities. And that's a cause for concern.
Can you imagine the outrage if Obama had appointed a family member from the Republicans?
Well, especially one of his, tween daughters.
Exactly.
That would have been outrageous.
Malia as national security advisor.
But it's not like there aren't political dynasties in America. It's not that there haven't been family relations.
No,
we had two presidents in the last, 30 years that were father and son.
And Jack Kennedy had Bobby Kennedy as his attorney general.
Yeah. But there are ways that are perhaps, the question of whether Trump has, crossed the line, giving Ivanka Trump a space in the White House in the West Wing, as well as, although she's not being paid, she's being given access to intelligence, right? So that causes all kinds of issues to arise. But that's an American conversation.
It is. Can I tell you one thing, though, Sharad? I think all of the Trump administration needs some access to intelligence.
Oh, ouch. Okay, but that's not the same kind of intelligence we're talking about. Okay. On the Ringgit Sense, when we try to improve your financial literacy and financial intelligence, we're going to be having Felix Nyo. He's our guest today. So look forward to that. That's after the 9:30 bulletin. Now, very quickly, just a quick look at the news overnight. United Airlines boss, Oscar Munoz, says he will not resign. And while he felt shame and embarrassment, he vowed that this incident, because the incident that's now trending on Twitter and everybody's seen the video of that passenger being forcibly removed from the plane in a somewhat bloody fashion, is never going to happen again. He apparently had attacked the passenger. That was his first reaction, was to attack the passenger, David Dow, saying that he was disruptive and belligerent.
That's right. They released an email that he sent out to all of his employees saying that, you know, I'm very proud of the way United managed this situation and stuck together, and the passenger was being disruptive and belligerent, and now it's just a series of backtracks because you've seen how their stock price has reacted. The morning after trading on United, I think they wiped out like some $600 million from their value.
Yeah. And of course, rivals have come out, you know, with their clever, you know, retorts. I mean, I think one rival airline says, we like to beat our competitors, but not you. And something to that effect, right? And basically, it's a PR disaster of such a huge magnitude. I mean, because this happens in a highly mediatized world, you're constantly having to be careful about your messaging. But why an established company like this could not get it right, I'm surprised.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. And also, you know, the random selection of an Asian-looking person in the current American climate means that the discourse immediately turns to racism.
Yeah.
Why did you pick him?
That's right. So, you know, the idea that he was profiled and therefore, you know, targeted because of that. Now, the fact that, you know, a lot of airlines have global markets, your market that identifies ethnically with that person might feel like, maybe I don't want to travel in your airline because of this.
Well, funny you say that. There was an article in Bloomberg that implied the exact same thing. They're saying that the reason the stock crashed was because Asian investors in China felt that it was an act of racism.
And they're a huge market.
Well, America is pandering to China in every way, right? Hollywood is pandering to China because they dominate the economy at the moment.
Yeah, so, you know, so bad move. Now there's a kind of 180-degree turnaround. They're promising to rectify the situation. But is it, a case of too little, too late? And we see that all over. We had, of course, that also a bit of a foot-and-mouth issue with the White House spokesman, Sean Spicer. You know, referring to... this is where, again, you know, access to intelligence is so important. He made mention of Hitler and not using gas.
Well, now it was a hilarious video. He's talking about Assad, okay? And he gets Assad's name wrong in almost every pronunciation. And then he goes on to say, well, you know, this is ridiculous. I mean, we look at World War II. Even someone like Hitler
did not use chemical weapons.
And the journalist in the room just goes, I'm sorry, could you, as she repeats his quote, and she says, could you please clarify what you meant by that? And he spends the next 30 seconds stumbling over himself, calling Auschwitz a memorial. Like, oh, yeah, no, it was different. Hitler didn't bomb a city. He took them to the memorial, and he was all over the place. It was a train wreck.
Yeah, and it's a train wreck because, you know, I think when people try to communicate, they try to make absolutes. So, you know, often this is like the worst ever. And so nothing else can compare. And then because, you know, just lacking your a good sense of history. And I think if Nazi Germany is remembered for anything, it's remembered for its gas chambers. I mean, if that's not chemical warfare, you know, maybe contained in a room, but still,
and
it's
also
chemical warfare.
Given the history over the last 80 odd days that Trump has had with the Jewish community in America, it hasn't been very good. They keep rolling out Jared Kushner as his son-in-law every time he makes a mistake. It just adds fuel to the fire.
Yeah. It's also, if you remember, mustard gas from World War I.
Correct.
I mean, how could you, you probably haven't read any poetry. If you, the war poetry coming out of, I think, World War I would remind you of the atrocities committed there. I don't think
that's on Sean Spicer's bedside table.
I believe he's actually apologized.
He has.
For that.
He was on CNN and he apologized.
He did apologize, which is also rare because, the Trump administration's press people have understood their task as attacking the press. I think that's the primary thing. Anyway, we'll be back with more news and views after this at BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Morning Run continues, and that was Superfly by Curtis Mayfield. So taking you back to the funky 50s, 60s, 70s.
70s, 70s, 70s it was through from that. The soundtrack of Superfly, the movie.
Oh, is it a movie?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
One of those blaxploitation films, great movie.
Oh,
great movie.
You know, because there was Jackie Brown.
That's right.
It has a great
soundtrack.
Oof, yes. But I believe it's banned here.
Is it really?
I mean, I think you can't actually get the album because of some expletives that are used in one of the songs.
Oh, yeah, I will look that up.
Yeah, but censorship is such a futile endeavor in this day and age, isn't it? I mean, who can, in fact, stop information and products coming through?
You may not be able to buy it in stores, but I'm sure you can listen to it on Spotify.
You can listen to it just about everywhere.
Exactly.
Yeah, so yeah, the store thing is just one dimension. That is Umar Pagan Ampika Pagan.
Oh, hello. I am not Julian Ng.
And you're not, definitely not Sharad Kutin, who is me. I'm Sharad Kutin. He's Umar Pagan Ampika Pagan. We are often mistaken for each other. But we've worked out
a
really neat strategy, haven't we?
Yes. So there are times, occasionally when someone recognizes your work and comes up to you and goes, hey, are you Sharad Kutin? I listen to you on the morning all the time. And initially I'd be like, no, I'm Uma. I'm on the evening. But now I just go, hey, thanks, man. Yeah. I just take credit for your work, Sharad, all the
time.
People
are confused because I have people come up to me and say, oh, I expected you to have hair. And of course, they're probably thinking about you. And
Thanks, buddy.
But anyway. We are, in fact, two separate people from two separate parents, sets of parents. Okay.
Proof that Batman and Bruce Wayne are indeed different people. No.
A holy doppelganger. Okay. We're just picking up on that United Airlines story. I mean, one of the things that
story's got legs.
Yeah. Underscores this controversy is two facts. One is that airlines are allowed to overbook a flight, and two, they have a right to remove you if it is in fact overbooked.
Yeah, so this overbooking thing is a very interesting thing. It's practiced a lot in the United States. In Asia, not so much. I know certain premium airlines, if you want to call them, like Singapore Airlines and stuff like that, don't necessarily practice the kind of overbooking that something like United would. And I found it very difficult to get my head around this notion of overbooking a flight. I mean, every flight does have a certain amount of drop-offs, but how does it work and what does it mean to the passenger? So,
yeah, how would you manage the disappointment? Everybody's there with their suitcases. The kids are so excited. They're going to Disneyland.
Normally, they throw money at you. So they'll say, oh, we're so sorry, but here's $1,000 and a 5-star hotel room. And hopefully that'll make you feel better.
And we'll put you on the next available flight.
Right? But we got in touch with, over the evening edition, because we were really confused about this, we got in touch with Ron Bishop, who's a senior lecturer in aeronautical science and aviation at CQ University in Australia. And we asked him about this whole overbooking thing and just how common a practice it was.
Yeah, actually, it's very common, and all of them do it. Some of them do it less than others, but what they do is they overbook because they're assuming that some of the people won't show up. So in the past, that's always worked out fairly well because they're pretty close to being right. A lot of people didn't show up for the flight, and then they would be able to be pretty close to full or full, which is what they want to be. What's happening now, though, is that we treat flying airplanes like we do buses. And so people are more relying on it. Just like this guy did. He was a doctor. He had patients that he had to see the next morning, and he wasn't willing to get off I guess they offered him a couple hundred dollars, and he was unwilling to give up his seat.
Right. So, see, when passengers buy an airline ticket, Sharad, they aren't actually paying for a seat on the plane.
They're not?
Okay, so we asked Ron what people were actually paying for when they buy a ticket.
They're not paying for the seat. They're actually entering what we call a contract of carriage. And that contract of carriage basically is just saying that you're in a contract to be carried by this airline. And although you, as a passenger, you have almost, you have some rights, but not very many. There's some code of federal regulations in the states that cover it. IATA covers it a little bit. But really, the question I would ask is, why were people allowed to get all the way onto the plane, get into their seat, and, you know, everything stowed, and then asked to be moved later on? Normally they catch them at the gate, which is the smart way to do it, because then you don't have that scene that you had there.
All right, that was Ron Bishop, Senior Lecturer in Aeronautical Science and Aviation at CQ University Australia.
A contract of carriage.
Exactly.
Now that's fascinating.
That's some great legalese, right?
Yeah. So they don't say that to you when you go to the website and you buy a ticket and you pick your seat.
Yeah.
They don't say, oh, by the way, all this is an illusion. All you have really is this flimsy thing called a contract of carriage and not much more. I mean, so they are bound to take you from point A to point B, but...
And bound to give you a replacement if they cannot.
But
they are also perfectly within their rights to say, we cannot accommodate you on this plane.
Okay, so that seat isn't yours.
It isn't yours. But what Ron said just now was correct. More often than not, what happens is, when you're at the check-in desk, when you're face-to-face with that individual behind the desk, they often make you a deal. If they find, they know, right? When a plane is overbooked, they know all the stuff that's going on. And that's happened to me before. And actually, you know what? It's happened to our colleague at BFM, Sonia Chi, and she got a great deal out of it. I remember, I think she was coming back, I can't remember what country she was coming back, France or something. And they said, you know, we have to move you, but we're going to give you a voucher for a ticket to another destination of your choice at a later date. Well, I mean, I'm happy to move for that.
Yeah, I know. I can imagine. So the question that...
And sometimes they upgrade you to business or first class.
Right. So, okay. So this was the debate that we had, that the solution was a very simple one. If at $200, you know, that doctor wouldn't move, all you have to say is, okay, we'll open it up. Who would take $500? And you just have a little auction, and you just auction this removal. But... you know, and then maybe that would have been a happier solution, because somebody would say, well, I'm not meeting my patients. I can, in fact, be more flexible. In fact, three of the four who were asked to move did, in fact, move, didn't they?
Took the money.
They took the money. And so, okay. So, and again, so this is yet another layer on the controversy, is that they should have managed it at the check-in.
They should have managed it at the check-in.
Because obviously, you know, you're typing things in. You know the plane is filled up. How could they have, in fact... put in more people, and then there's all this problem about taking luggage off.
And also there's this added outrage because it was an overbooked flight and they were replacing paying customers with United staff.
Ah.
So it was United pilots that needed to get to that destination. So there's added outrage by saying, why could you not find another way to get your pilots to that destination? This is a paying customer.
They would have had to take a rival airline, perhaps.
Maybe. Who knows?
Who knows?
But yeah, it's...
So, you know, having your processes in place, and perhaps this is a wonderful occasion for all of us to learn, because now I'm going to be repeating this mantra to myself. Contract of carriage. And I'll be saying, so when I take that taxi, have I bought a seat, or have I just entered into a contract of carriage? I think this is something that you could use at a party very successfully. I've invited you to my house. We have a contract of consumption.
Of food and beverage.
contract
of consumption.
Or something.
I may not necessarily give you food.
But no, I think you have to give food, but you might not have a seat at the table.
Ah, okay.
And I could even give it to you outside the house. I could pass you victuals through the window.
Ini bukan budaya kita, Sharad.
No, it isn't, I know. we're so polite. We are halus. I think halus is hashtag halus. Okay. Next up, we have the first bulletin of the day, and we have Lynn Mark poised at the mic to give it to you, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Morning Run continues, and that was Fool's Gold by the Stone Roses, a band from the 80s.
That's right.
I'm always looking to Timothy Kang, one of our producers, who knows
he's a bit of a music connoisseur.
Yeah, my God, he's a singer-songwriter. And, he sort of like holds up his, thin fingers, like Thin Lizzy or the Thin Duke, I don't know, all these things. Anyway, I don't know anything about music. He just told me to cut it off and move on.
These young people these days are very rude. No respect for the elders.
Well, we've actually had people tweeting in, surprised that voice that you hear, I'm sure I couldn't because you hear me every morning, but that voice you probably heard from a different time zone.
That's right. I'm not Julian Ng.
You're not Julian Ng.
No.
You're not Tan Chung Han.
I'm not.
You're not Melissa Idris. You're not Kusu Chuang, all the regular voices on The Morning Run. You are, in fact, let me tell you this, you are Uma Pagan Ambika Pakin.
Yes. And you know what, Sharad? We are different people.
You're different people. Nick Azan Shah tweeted and he says, I thought I was still dreaming when I heard Uma Pagan early this morning. You're not dreaming. This is hashtags of banana, a fact. Uma is on The Morning Run today. Thank you so much, Uma, for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
And of course, this is something really, not just from a time zone, but from a different planet, a planet that you, live on.
Inhabit.
Almost exclusively, I think at least from my point of view, which is the world of comic books. And you've actually had some really successful series on the Evening Edition looking at comics, haven't you, and comic characters and characterization.
And their cultural impact, yeah.
And that cultural, because you've given some heft to what otherwise would be a slightly fluffy endeavor.
We try to. Yeah. We try to.
No, because that's the Evening Edition. Getting a bit night school, I think, is
hello.
Yeah. So, okay, tell us about this story that's going around.
That's right.
And that takes us, in fact, across the Straits of Malacca to Indonesia.
Yeah, I mean, and the
cue the music from Indonesia.
Cue some Wayang Kulit, right? The Ahok story made it to international news in a strange way.
Okay, so Ahok is the governor of Jakarta.
That's right.
First ethnic Chinese
Christian
governor of Jakarta. He, of course, was a longtime associate of the current president, Joko Widodo, or Jokowi as he's affectionately known.
And what was interesting was there is a comic book artist called Ardian Sayaf, and he was commissioned by Marvel Comics to write a new series of the popular X-Men comic book called X-Men Gold. And that came out last Wednesday. Over the weekend, a story broke saying that Indonesians had picked up on secret messaging within this comic book. And Ardian Sayaf had put in his own, hinted at his own political beliefs by alluding to the Ahok protests in his comic book. So there's a character called Colossus, and on his T-shirt had the words QS551 or Quran Surah 551. And that was the verse that they were quoting during the protests against Ahok. Now, as to what the verse actually translates to is debatable because scholars are debating that. But in this case, it is widely believed to be translated to something like, do not accept Christians and Jews as your friends and leaders. And so it is widely interpreted to be Islamist and anti-Christian and anti-Semitic.
Right. So there has been, I think, in fact, when he first became the governor of Jakarta, there were segments, perhaps small segments, but very vocal ones, who said, we don't want to accept him as the governor of Jakarta. And in a recent case against him that, in a speech that he made, he allegedly offended the sensitivities of Muslims.
Yes.
By making reference to religious text. That became an issue and became another rallying point for those who always never accepted the legitimacy of the electoral process, the democratic process that put him in power.
Yeah, but this isn't anything new. Artists hiding secret messages.
Yeah, I love that. Secret messages are there because comic books are nothing. They're kind of for children, but they're done by adults. And
yes.
Adults always like to sneak in their in-jokes.
Sex jokes.
Yeah, so there's always this thing, but what is this stuff, the spidey web coming out of Spidey's palm, right? They're all these kind of like vague, veiled
innuendos,
sexual innuendos often.
But why I found the story incredibly exciting is that it could have only broken in this way in today's world. Because it is such an inside point of view that if there wasn't Facebook and Twitter, Americans, British would never pick up on these references. It's only the local Indonesian, even the Malaysian would not have picked up on that reference. But if you are in Indonesia, if you're in Jakarta, if you are following those protests, then this message means something to you. But in this world where suddenly it spreads like wildfire to think that he was promoting anti-Semitism and anti-Christian rhetoric, he's lost his job. He's being criticized across the board, and suddenly it becomes a global issue.
Has he come out to defend himself or explain what happened?
So initially he came out and defended himself and went, oh, you know, you don't understand the nuance of Indonesian politics. It's a local thing. It's got nothing to do with you guys. And then, of course, he discovered that that was a losing battle, especially when you're spouting that kind of rhetoric or what people believe to be hate rhetoric. And so Marvel has since terminated his contract, and it's likely he's never going to – I mean – in the American context, when you've said something that is even remotely anti-Christian or anti-Semitic, it's unlikely that you're going to work for those organizations again.
Right. So he's actually, he came out and he posted a statement. He says, hello, worlds. And that's interesting, worlds.
That's right.
He says, my career is now over. It's a consequence of what I did and I take it. Please no more mockery, debate, or no more hate. I hope all in peace, he says. And he says, the number is of justice. So he tries to give his interpretation of why that number was there, QS551. He says, my apologies for all the noise. Goodbye. May God bless you all. I love you, Adrian Shayef.
Yeah.
Shayef. Okay, so again, you know, I mean, how much has this ever happened in the world of comic books, this idea that there's these secret messages and people have come out and say, well, you know, this is anti-Semitic or anti-women, misogynistic and anti-women. I mean, have there been things like that?
Yes. Plenty. I mean, back in the 60s and 70s, God, there was so much misogynistic stuff in comic books, right? There were some comic book writers who would hate their editors. And then
I don't think you're allowed to laugh while you say misogynistic.
No, but you know what I mean. I mean, we're trying to think that in 2017, things have gotten better. But there are comic book artists who've hated their editors and they've put secret messages against their editors into their artwork. And then, of course, there are comic book artists who are just, you know, big-time pervs who have sex references in almost every page.
Okay, so this is the other thing, right? I think often with secret messaging, because this is quite kind of in some ways on the nose, right? It's the actual kind of thing that would have gone on a placard in a protest.
Yes.
But usually there's ambivalence. So you're not quite sure if this is approving or disapproving, right? So who is this character Colossus? I mean, having the QS 551 on his T-shirt or on his spandex clingy costume, does that make him a champion of this? And is he a good character?
Well, he's a good character. But what's interesting is if when people read the message behind QS551, or at least how it's interpreted, in a comic book like X-Men, which has largely been a metaphor for minority rights, because the mutants being oppressed by society at large has often been adopted to mean homosexuals being oppressed by, you know, it's been used for a metaphor for everything from race to sexuality. And so for such a liberal comic to have these kinds of anti-religious messages, I think that's what people took tremendous offense to. And they started lashing out at Marvel for it, saying that, well, you've spent the last 40 years on this comic book talking about minority rights and oppression, and then you let this artist come and do this? How dare you?
Okay, so the question is the response, and we've had this all the time, right? People resigning, careers destroyed over a misstep, perhaps you want to call it that. I mean, is that
young and
fair?
Naive.
Is that fair? I mean, should a comic artist like Adrian, or Ardian rather,
Ardian Shayef,
you know, should his career be over?
I don't know. It's a useful indiscretion. I think he was, I genuinely think he was stupid for doing it.
Because he didn't understand the world in which his characters lived. I mean, meaning you're saying that...
Not only that, I completely disagree with his politics, right? If he genuinely believed the messaging of that, then I disagree with his politics. But I think people can change and people learn. And maybe this might be a learning thing for him.
Well, you know, is there a local Indonesian comic scene that he could continue to be?
Most probably, yes, there is a local Indonesian.
But this
comic
must have been
scene.
A real winner for him, right?
Of
an Indonesian comic artist writing for a global
one of the biggest brands in the world and one of the biggest comics in the world, X-Men.
Yeah,
huge.
So this is it. So this is very interesting, right? That There are kind of these politics, and these borders do get policed. And maybe it's a good thing. Maybe the world that promotes inclusiveness and a secular
diversity,
and diversity really needs to protect its borders against the barbarian hordes. Ha ha, I said it. We're coming up to the news at the top of the hour. But first, here's Let Forever Be by the Chemical Brothers on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.